afternoon. Good evening. I got it. This is Execution Watch. I am not Ray Hill. I'm Otis McClay. And Ray is doing his monthly show on television today, abandoning radio. Today, the death penalty in Texas is going to take another victim, Robert Hudson. And we will be talking about that and some philosophical issues. And with us on the line now is Dennis Longmire, who is in Huntsville in front of the Walls unit. Is that right, Dennis? Can you hear me? I'm not hearing anything. All right, Elizabeth. Fix it. And we're also here with Jim Skelton. Let me do a quick rundown of what this is about. Robert Hudson was sentenced to death in 2000. They grind slow for the murder of his former girlfriend. And he apparently called her and became upset when he heard a man's voice at her apartment. Went over there, broke in, stabbed her, slashed the neck of her 8-year-old son who tried to intercede. He didn't leave. Well, you said, Jim, he went to a
convenience store.
But he made no effort to evade, and apparently was extremely remorseful, and we'll be talking about that too. And is Dennis with us?
Yes, he is.
Hey, Dennis. So you're there at the Walls?
Yes, I am.
And what's happening?
Well, there are 10 of us out here on the corner. One of us is Robert Hudson's daughter, and she is crying. She's very, very visibly upset. There are three people here from England who are visiting, and they have their men on death row. Two of them have, married the men on death row. This is a painful experience for people on the corner who are connected to the case and or men on death row. And one of the women asked, she said, how can people not see what we are doing to the family members of the people that we execute, that we put them through so much turmoil and pain that is unnecessary? It's not like Robert Hudson is a threat to anyone right now. And it's just unbelievable to people who have to experience this, that we do it so regularly and without any real apparent concern for the feelings of others.
I got a question for you. Do you think if we had public executions with required attendance that perhaps this would change?
I like to think that, but to be quite honest, today I'm afraid that it would only accelerate things because it strikes me that we've become a culture that seems to get a great deal of joy out of other people's pain and strain. I'm cynical right now in this moment, so I'm sorry for that, but I think that if we had public executions, it would be on YouTube and everybody would be celebrating.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the story of Madame du Barry. In the French Revolution, the executions continued. You know about this, Jim?
Sure.
Yes.
And everybody went dignified to their death in truest aristocratic fashion, and Madame du Barry kicked and screamed and said, "Don't kill me," and they dragged her there, and that ended the executions.
Some men on death row make, and that is that they should not go out peacefully, that they should fight, and they should kick, and they should scream. I don't know what such is. But maybe if
Jimmy Cagney and
people saw that, it might have an influence. It might open our hearts.
Yeah. Have they gone in? Has the media gone in?
Yes. Those sets of witnesses have gone in. They went in about 5 minutes ago, I think.
Any witnesses for Hudson?
Yes, there were, it looked to me like 4 or 5 people who went in with for Mr. Hudson. And, of course, the media witnesses went in before him.
All right, then I guess what we'll do is do what we always do, which is wait. Until we get the message from you, and then we'll report that on Execution Watch. Anything else, Dan? Go ahead.
You understand. Right now on the corner, there are people from England, people from Germany, people from Texas. They're outraged.
Can you get near one of them and maybe let them say something?
Absolutely. One second.
What a great idea. I'm glad I came up. Oh, it was Jim's idea.
Hi.
No, it was Elizabeth's idea, yeah. The producer.
Elizabeth.
Still ask you a question. Are you there?
Yeah.
Here, this is Carl. He's a frequent visitor here. One second. Just to answer whatever question.
Yes, I'm Carl Rotenberg from Germany. If you want to ask me questions.
Well, I guess I just wondered, you know, tell me.
I cannot hear you well.
I know. You're not going to be able to. I could go over here. Carl, tell me why you do this.
Why you do this?
No, why you do this.
Well, I've been visiting at the Polanski unit all day today and saw two people in two special visits, 8 hours long. And I've been doing this for more than 20 years. I've been coming over here to Texas, Arizona, California, and Florida, visiting people on death rows because I'm against the death penalty.
I don't know what to say. I mean, yes, we all agree.
Yeah, because, I've been against the death penalty always. Ever since I can think of problems like that, and we don't have the death penalty in Europe except one country, and that's Belarus. All the other members of the European Union and the Council of Europe, they have abolished the death penalty. If they want to join, they have to abolish the death penalty before they can join, you know.
I mean, worldwide, it's amazing the extent to which people have recognized that this is a useless, expensive, and very socially damaging tool.
Right.
And we
there's a lot of outrage in European countries about the United States still having the death penalty. And the justice system obviously is broken. I know of so many cases that people did not get justice.
Right.
One of my friends over here in Texas, he is a young man who was looking for a father figure. He didn't have a father. I mean, he had a biological father, but he abandoned him when he was 4 years old. And he probably obviously found a father figure in my person. And he called me dad, and I'm... Now I'm 80 years old, and he was killed, and he was a juvenile delinquent. He was 17 years old when it happened, and if they had changed the law a few years earlier, he wouldn't have been executed.
Mm.
And where's the justice for him?
Well, I mean, it seems that justice has been forgotten. In a lot of this, the word has changed its meaning.
The system, to my understanding, is broken and rotten, I think.
All right, Carl. Thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you for being an example.
I'll pass you on to Dennis somewhere again.
Okay, thanks.
Hello.
And Dennis, I guess you'll call.
One thing also, just until I heard Carl talking, just today, the United Nations passed a resolution calling for a worldwide moratorium on the death penalty. The United Nations is behind this also. It's not just something that a small group of people from other countries seem to be concerned about. On Monday, in Huntsville, Texas, there's going to be a Pilgrimage for Life that is being sponsored by the Catholic Church. Cardinal DiNardo is going to be here, and there's going to be a vigil walk, and people are walking from our local church to the corner where we execute people because of the Roman Catholic Church's opposition to the death penalty. This is not a small problem the United States has to deal with. It's a huge problem. It's a huge problem globally and spiritually that we have to reconcile.
Okay. Yes, and
I will call you when anything else happens with them coming out.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Dennis Longmire at the Walls Unit today. And he's there watching people troop into the walls, and then nothing happens, and then they troop out.
Right.
And we know that one more person has died in the name of something that apparently Texas thinks is important. Jim, what is it about this case? Why What's interesting about this case, besides the fact that a guy's going to lose his life?
When I was reviewing this, I couldn't help but remember what I had read years ago. There was a book written by a guy named David Remnick on Muhammad Ali, and they were describing Sonny Liston, the famous boxer, and they made this comment: he died the day he was born, which meant he never really had a chance. And I felt much the same way about Robert Hudson, because unfortunately this is one of those horrible classic tales that we go over and over again. We have a member of a minority, an African-American man born in Dallas in a metropolitan area, and apparently from what I can find out from reading the trial transcripts, he'd been abused as a child, had not had a good father figure, got into some problems, then he went to the penitentiary at a fairly young age. In fact, he was ended up overall convicted 8 different times on 8 different convictions in the penitentiary, had committed 1 prior murder. He had apparently was in jail when he was charged with that prior murder, and he pled to it. Parole, this was his 3rd time being out on parole. He paroled twice before and got his parole revoked. And this time what happened, he'd been out of jail about 6 months. And he'd been dating this woman by the name of Edith Kendrick. And as you said earlier, he called Edith Kendrick on the phone and heard a man's voice in the background. And he just, to use his phrase, he just kind of lost it. And he went in the house and began to, in fact, he ran into the house and kicked in the door, and the man that was in the background escaped. Whoever happened to be visiting, we don't know whether it was another boyfriend or just a man there at the house. He took off, supposedly to run for help. And at this point, Hudson just lost control. He said he just lost and started slashing, and this lady, his 8-year-old son, tried to intervene, and he got cut up pretty badly. In fact, he got his cut, they say, from ear to ear. Of course, that could be an exaggeration, but he got cut very badly trying to defend his mother. The mother escaped. He drug her back and killed her. And then when he did, he left the apartment but didn't leave the scene. He was arrested shortly thereafter at a convenience store, confessed to doing the killing, had some property that he had taken, a bloody watch, and some more property taken out of the apartment, and seemed to be very remorseful about it. And what is tragic about this, now we've talked about this before, is that in a real genuine sense, what we've created are people like Robert Hudson, the way we run our penal institutions, because we destroy the very fabric that makes people, makes a culture, and that's namely a family. And when people go to the penitentiary at a young age, the way they're treated and abused, they come out with a whole lot of anger. I know this from experience, because I had a real good friend named Sonny Sellers. He's now, Sonny Lyles, and he's dead now, so I can talk about it. And Sonny had been to the penitentiary like on 4 different occasions. And he told me the only reason he could go straight, the last time he got out of the pen, he went to work on a tugboat in the Houston Ship Channel and didn't get off the tugboat for something like 3 months, because he knew that if he got out, there was so much anger welled up inside of him. If somebody popped off or did something wrong, he would hurt him. And I think the same thing here. This guy had been paroled about 6 months earlier, and he just simply lost it. And what makes it even a little bit more macabre is that it's obvious he felt remorseful about it, because during the trial itself, he instructed his lawyers not to put on any defense whatsoever. There were no witnesses called on his behalf, period. I mean, he showed up, but he was there in person only. He certainly didn't make any effort to defend himself. And the lawyers were in a kind of a big jam, because there was little question about evidence of guilt. I mean, everybody identified him. The 8-year-old identified him. He confessed to doing the killing. He was found a short distance away. The man he ran out of the house identified him as being the killer. There's no question about that. The only thing left to decide is whether or not he'd be a danger to the future. And absolutely no evidence was presented in his behalf at his request. And I think I've paralleled this as kind of like suicide by trial. He just wanted, it seems to me that from looking at this transcript, he felt horrible about what he had done, did not want to live, because he made absolutely no attempt to defend himself during the trial. Another issue that came up, at least some of the post-conviction writs, and he was on antidepressant medication, which is a nice way for saying he's on downers during the trial. And apparently during the trial, it had some effect upon him, because he claimed he could sleep and nod off during the trial. That was another big issue they talked about on the writ hearing. But again, our courts have been real slow and reluctant to do anything about that because they tend to want you to behave and act nice when they're trying to kill you. It seems kind of bizarre to me. They will tank you up with drugs if you misbehave or tie you up if you misbehave during a trial. And that was another issue on the writs. They discussed that, but it got absolutely no success out of the Fifth Circuit, out of the Court of Criminal Appeals. And it was just one of these tragic... Truthfully, we created, our penal system created this man. And it's a shame that a woman had to die as a result of it. It's a shame that some child has been scarred for life as a result of it. But part of it's society's own fault with the way we treat people when we incarcerate them.
One of the issues that come up recently is that a lot of people who got ridiculously long sentences in the 80s are getting out now. And they're angry.
Well,
we don't protect ourselves as a society. I mean, the way to protect yourself is make friends, generally. That's the most secure thing you can do. If you've lived in a neighborhood in New York, you know that. You make friends. That's how you...
Well, see, one of the things that I'm a great believer in this, the thing that builds any type of culture is family. And it's what keeps people from breaking the law is not fear of getting caught. What makes most people behave is they don't want to disappoint their friends. If their friends think highly of you and you do something wrong, you don't want to disappoint them. So your peer group can never, ever, ever be exaggerated. And you're going to bond with somebody. And what they're doing by not letting prisoners be able to make some money to support their family, they're creating bonds with other people who are in jail also, because their bonding are done with inmates rather than with family. And they identify themselves more as an inmate and a convict because that's who they're with every day.
You see that as a gang, for instance?
Well, it's like a gang. The gang is the same sort of thing. Gang's an exaggeration of that same trait. But what happens, we should understand that we should try to keep those bonds of family together. And there's several ways to do that. Number one, I think we should permit inmates, when they're working in prison, to be paid some salary, some nominal sum. That way they can feel good about themselves. They can support their family. I think they should also permit wives to come in and spend weekends with their husbands and to build a family bonding up together. And if they have children, let the children come in, maybe spend a weekend at a hotel with them or a hotel at some facility where they can bond with one another. Because they're going to bond with somebody. I mean, that's just human nature to bond. And if you don't provide a good environment for them to bond with decent people, they're going to bond with other people who get in trouble all the time, identify themselves as convicts. It's just stupid what we're doing, and then we exaggerate it worse because when a person gets out of the pen, we talked about this before, under some of our housing requirements for public housing, they will not let people with prior convictions live there. And a lot of these poor people come out of poor areas. So they get out of prison, and one, they can't go stay with their parents because they live in public housing. They can't get a job because nobody will hire them. And we also should do something, it just seems logical to me, I've never understood this, we should do something when people are in the pen to have some type of release program back into the community. More like a halfway house where we treat them, teach them some sort of skills and teach them some sort of, let them kind of work back. And even like in the wars, we've had instances, people came back from battlefronts. We slowly integrated them to society, got them to get readjusted again.
Sometimes.
And what we do basically with these people, we just give them some money, a bus ticket, and dump them. And then we wonder why in the hell they get in trouble again.
Well, so consistent, though, you know, and maybe this is something we want to talk about with Steve Hall as well, who's, we're going to be talking to in a little while right now. This is Execution Watch. I'm Otis McLean. We're talking with Jim Skelton, who is the regular conscience here.
I hope not.
Right. Oh, that takes all the fun out.
What
is it about us, though? I mean, I think this is a human thing of marginalizing certain people in order to feel better, because it's so consistent in our penal system all across the country for the most part. I mean, even in states like Vermont, you know, which are pretty advanced socially. What is it about us that makes us have to treat people this way and make it very clear to them that we don't want them in society and that they're worthless, which I think is the most dangerous thing you can do?
See, I would like to think that it's because we're a young nation as opposed to an older, mature nation like Europe. They tend to be more mature and have an older culture. And they seem to be much more civilized, but this sort of things we do here in the States. And we've kind of got that John Wayne mentality over here that we have, kind of like a young person's got. And there's an old adage among criminal lawyers, if you're going to go to trial, if you think you're going to get a lot of time, pick people, older people. They know what the hell 60 years means. If you're 18, you don't know what it means. And there's always been an old adage among criminal lawyers that older people tend to be more moderate, tend to be more understanding than younger people do. And it could be because we're a young culture. A part of it, I think a whole lot, and this is one of the more bizarre things about our life, the funny thing is that the best place to get killed in our society is in the Bible Belt. And that's always been a very strange thing, that Christianity supposedly is to teach understanding, compassion, and love, and forgiving. And yet the area that's the Bible Belt, like in the South, is where basically all your capital murder cases come from. In fact, the meanest juries in the state of Texas are in East Texas. In East Texas, people up there primarily do two things, make false teeth and get born again. They're big on churches. I think a lot of the fundamental religious beliefs that we have, I think that contributes a lot to it. And I think that's one of the factors that makes us so terribly mean and judgmental. And because if you'll notice, like in Europe, there's a lot more people in Europe who tend to be more agnostic, not less prone by religious, a lot of the fundamentalist religion doctrine that we have in this country. I think that's a factor. I think there's a more mature nation. I don't think religion plays that big of a role in Europe like it does here, because I was reading somewhere here not long ago where I think a majority of Europeans were either agnostic or didn't particularly believe in God one way or the other. Whereas over here, that's a major issue, and for some strange reason, that seems to make us meaner rather than more gentle and kind. I think that has to do with it.
So I've wondered about that, because as far as I know, and you know, I have read the Bible and done some studying, I don't remember Jesus telling us to kill anybody.
Well, if you take
or go to war or any of the other
things. Well, of course not. I mean, in fact, the truth of the matter is Christ himself died as a death penalty case. He was given the death penalty himself.
Right.
And that's the way they executed back then. They didn't have gurneys with needles. They didn't have electric chairs. They had crosses and wooden spikes. And they killed him. They gave him a death sentence back in those days. Another thing, and again, another thing about this case that our courts have never really handled well, is it permissible to permit somebody to order his lawyer not to put on a defense? And the best way I know to give this as an example, we've been pretty liberal in this country about permitting people to represent themselves, even when they're just as crazy as a bedbug. There was a case out of Texas here not long ago on a death penalty case where a guy had an M1 carbine and went over and killed his in-laws, killed some more people, kidnapped them, and he killed a number of people dressed up in military garb. And he wanted to defend himself, and they permitted him to do it, and he dressed up part of the time in a purple cowboy suit in front of a jury and was just as crazy as a bedbug. Because here's the problem. To be meant to legally be incompetent, there's got to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist that says that you haven't got the ability to communicate with your lawyer. Well, if you can tell him what happened, you have the ability to communicate. And secondly, you got to understand why you're going to trial. But you can still be crazy as a peach orchard shoat and still have those characteristics. And this is what, at least in that area, we had a Supreme Court case that came out in this past term that may change that. Case out of Indiana, in which a guy wanted to represent himself. And they said, well, you're competent to go to trial, but we don't think you're competent enough to go to defend yourself because you'll make a mockery of the system. I think the same principle should be applied in death penalty cases. In this particular case, what he basically did by ordering his lawyer to put on no defense, he represented himself through his surrogate lawyers. And then the lawyers were pretty well hamstrung. And in a case like that, I think the courts have got an obligation. I think the legal system has got an obligation to protect people from themselves. And this is one of the strangest aspects of our law, is that we let people who literally are crazy They're not mental. They're not legally crazy. Defend themselves and call the shots. They'd be like me going to a HEB store and getting a can opener, getting a book and doing an appendectomy. We wouldn't permit that. I mean, we'd stop it. But yet we permit these people, like this guy here, to put on absolutely no defense whatsoever, put on no evidence to defend himself, and our courts permit that.
Yeah, the court, theoretically, their job is to protect society. I mean, theoretically, that's what the legal system is for, isn't it?
Laws, I think, are to protect society. I think the courts are there to be fair, make sure the laws are fairly enforced. And you can't fairly enforce the law if you get some nut defend himself. I mean, you can't do it. That's not. I mean, that doesn't make any. That doesn't make good sense. Any more than a hospital permits you to come in and do your own surgery on yourself, they would stop that in a heartbeat.
Now, in the appeal, though, this issue was raised, incompetence of counsel.
Right.
And is that considered an error on the part of...
Let me tell you how the incompetency of counsel works. Here's the problem. There's a case called Strickland versus Washington. And you've got to do two things to prove your lawyer is incompetent. Number one, you've got to prove that he was negligent and made a mistake. That's step number one. It's like a negligence deal in a car wreck. And where you really get in trouble, you got to prove but for the negligence, the result would have been different. And let me give you a real good example. Right after Strickland came out, there was a case in Oklahoma in which a guy was kiting checks. And kiting checks is when they open up different bank accounts in different states and bounce checks. And he was kiting checks between Florida and Oklahoma. And it took the Justice Department something like 3 years to put the case together. And they appointed a lawyer on that case who had never, ever tried a criminal case before. And what happened after they tried the case, he got convicted on everything. And they ruled the lawyer was negligent because the evidence was so overwhelming it wouldn't have made any difference if he had every lawyer in the world. And so here's your problem. What's a lawyer supposed to do when his client tells him, don't put any witnesses on? Now, what's his obligation at that point? Because the Sixth Amendment gives you the right to defend yourself and say what you want to say. Now, lawyers have this trouble. A lot of times a guy wants to testify in his own trial. You think it's foolhardy to do so. And what's your obligation as a lawyer? We don't have any guidelines from the courts on that. And it just seems to me that if a person... I think we have a call coming in, Lois. Okay, let's go ahead and get your call.
No, when she's ready. Okay. This is Dennis.
Hello.
Hi.
All of the witnesses have exited and returned back into the administration building. Mr. Hudson's family and friends are getting ready to leave. I'm sure they're going to go to the funeral home to visit with him one time before burial. So that's where we are.
Yep.
Are you still there?
One more time. Yes, I'm speechless. I don't honestly know what to say. It's embarrassing to be a party to this, to have people killing people in my name. And what are the other people saying? What's going on with the people who were watching?
Yeah, it's very, very sad. I come out here. I've been coming out here a lot, and sometimes they're a lot more difficult than others, but tonight, I'm watching them now walk away. There are four women holding each other up.
That's his family.
One of them is, she looks to be maybe 18, 17 years old, and she's Robert Hudson's daughter. We didn't have to do this to her. She doesn't deserve this. If you have compassion for victims of violence, we've got to have compassion for the family members and the loved ones of the people that we execute, too. They're human. They're part of our spirits and our souls. We are more than this.
Yeah, that's what many of us think, and there seems to be some group that feels that the more powerful we are, the more people we should kill, or vice versa.
Yeah, I think it's the vice versa. I think the powerful we are, the fewer people we need to kill, because we don't need this. Rob Hudson was not a threat or a danger. He had not been a violent person before the crime. the crime was an incident of loss of control. What we did tonight is an example of abuse of control, not loss, an abuse of power. It's unnecessary.
And it's not a good example.
No. It's exactly the wrong example to send to everybody. I just don't understand. I don't understand how we can continue doing this without feeling a sense of shame.
I don't mind a little dead air. Professor Dennis Longmire at Sam Houston, thank you.
Thank you. I will talk to you all maybe next year.
I hope not.
I hope not, too. Thank you for what you do. I know Ray isn't there, but thank Ray for continuing his hard work on this what I'll call this project. I think it's an important project.
Yes.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, the DeBerry theory, maybe some consciousness would help, because we hide it. I mean, we hide these events. You know, Mike, I can think of Mike Grouchik. We ought to have him on sometime. Has he said no?
No, he hasn't said no.
Okay. Well, Mike's very retiring, but he's been going, he's the AP reporter, and he's been reporting this process for the past 25 years. You know, I mean, that very interesting how he
One of the things that comes to mind, Ray had mentioned this earlier, and when he was asking about it, I was thinking about something I'd read years ago. H.G. Wells wrote a book called The Outline of History. And one of the things he talked about in that book is how Christianity and how Buddhist and how Hindu faith has ritualized, has gone away from its original teachings. And what he basically said, that's the reason men invented rituals. It's a lot easier to go through a ritual, keep your conniving heart to yourself, rather than surrendering yourself to an idea. And I think that's part of what we do with the death penalty, while we have it so ritualized in what the last meal was, what the last word spoken. We have that routine that people go through, because what it does, it gets your mind off the fact that you're killing somebody. And what it is just like a ritual in Christianity. It's a lot easier to pretend and go through a litany of words that are meaningless and save your conniving heart. And by the same token, it's a lot easier to have a ritual that we go through. And that, you're not thinking about you're actually killing somebody. You're thinking about the pattern, the walk, what they ate last. And have that little ritual you go through. And that's a function it serves. It diverts your attention away from the horror of what you're doing.
I see that everywhere, a lot of places. I mean, the court itself. I hate to say that, you know, this isn't true always, but to somehow lionize the judge. And it's interesting that you have judges that you know perfectly well are totally corrupt, or attorneys who are, and yet we have to treat them with great honor. Somehow requiring, or parents, people who require respect without earning it. I don't know.
We're in Houston, Texas.
There's a hypocrisy in our humanity, something in our behavior that leaves us there. All right. Elizabeth, we have. That's not going to work. You got to push the right button. You got to get the right button. No, the right.
Yeah.
Okay. Elizabeth's going to have. I got to say to our listeners, it's hard to do this here. Normally, we would have a separate place where she could, you know, express her frustration.
There's a death penalty for being a fumble bum. She'd be in trouble, wouldn't she?
Yeah, but it's not her fault. It's very difficult to do this. She's got to lean over a desk, and you know, and the phone system itself is not the same one that we use in the other studio. It's much harder to use. But we do the best we can, because, frankly, doing a show about executions is not real popular somehow. People don't really want to know about this. And, of course, that's why we're doing it. That's why Ray and Elizabeth started this thing.
Hold this time. I will not lose you. Okay, hang on, please.
Yeah. There we go. And this is... Who do we have?
Nadamo.
Hello?
Nadamo.
Yes.
And you are in Germany.
I'm in Germany, yes.
Nadamo Winter. And you were corresponding with Robert Hudson.
Yes, I was corresponding with him for about 2 years, and I got some 14, 15 letters from him. And one I got just a few days ago, the last one.
Can you tell us about what that conversation was like?
Well, actually, I'm with Amnesty here in Solingen, in Germany, in Cologne, and we have a group here, and we're meeting once a month. And there is an action at Christmas that we get the name of a prisoner if we want to participate, and then he's getting 10 euros from everybody who is participating, and a nice Christmas card. And this, many members, they participate each year, and then the prisoner may write back. So 2 years ago, I got the first letter from Robert, and this is how we got my pen pal and how we started writing to each other.
Tell me about, what did you find out about Robert?
Pardon me?
What did you find out about Robert?
There's a woman here in Germany, her name is Christel Kollmann, and she's organizing this since 20 years, and she also knows Peter in Texas who delivered the money and sees that everybody has it on his account before Christmas. So this is going on since many years.
Well, tell me something about what you and Robert wrote about, or what Robert said to you. I'm just curious what, you know, would have come from him that's not the same as what, you know, the guards would see, or somebody, a reporter talking to him.
Well, actually, he seems to be a very spiritually interested person. He got to know that I'm a Buddhist and that I'm meditating since a long time, and that I have been a long time in India, and that I have teachers in India. So he asked many questions about reincarnation and about meditation, and I actually also sent him four different books about different philosophies, Indian philosophy, and he was very, very interested in getting to know about it. And I got to know that he's painting, and my girlfriend, she bought one of his pictures, and it's in her home. And he's also writing very beautiful poems. And then he married a woman from Belgium, and I also had contact with her, and I talked with her. And I had the impression that he's a very happy and fulfilled person. He was writing in such beautiful words from his love to Chantal, who lives in Belgium. And it was just very, very touching letters, very, very touching letters. So I was very surprised to get such letters of such insight and love and wisdom. And he was reflecting about the human race and about black people and white people, and yeah, it was a great conversation. I loved it. It really touched me.
And is the group?
And I told many other people about it. And by tomorrow, I will probably type this last letter and send it around to many people. And also send some of the poems and thank everybody for helping. Because a lot of action was done. Amnesty did an action. The letters were written to Rick Perry and to Rissy Owens and to Craig Watkins, and a lot of letters were written and faxed. It seems it didn't help in the end.
No, and it seems to be a real battle here. We seem to be very much in love with the death penalty. Nadamo, I want to thank you for, you know, being part of Amnesty International and writing those letters to people who don't get much human contact. And I guess the group continues?
the group engineer?
No, it continues. Keeps on going.
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Of course. The group continues.
All right. I want to thank you. Anything else you want to leave us with?
Well, I would have wished I could have said a few last words to him, but today I tried about 3 hours to call officials in Texas. But they were all quite nice on the phone, but I only after 3 hours I got to talk to one attorney in person, but before that, everybody was saying, oh, we are not really in charge for this office. And when I called another office, and they again just told me to call somewhere else.
Yeah.
And they never put me through to anybody I wanted to talk to, and it was quite frustrating.
Well, it's actually designed that way. It's designed that way. It's not an accident. That's the system.
Yes.
Thank you, Nadamo.
Yes. Thank you very much.
I've got to move on.
Okay.
Nadamo Münter in Solingen. Solingen, I'm sorry.
Yes.
And a member of Amnesty International who's been corresponding with Robert Hudson. What? Okay, and now you're going to get Steve Hall. Okay. This is good because it gives people... listeners the chance to hear how, you know.
Notice something that has always bothered me about this. I've always been pretty active in representing so-called radical groups. And the frustration I've had, back years ago when I was in college, I used to be one of the large SDS, and I used to represent some of the more, you know, so-called wing group, nut groups. And the problem is we're real big on talk, bellyache, and little on action. And the only thing that society, the only way we're going to change this is not, sometimes we're preaching to the choir.
Right.
And the thing that bothers me is that we're doing very little except bellyaching and bitching about it. And the only way, I think we got a call coming, I'll pick it up after the end of the call.
Okay, well, maybe this may be something that we want to mention with Steve, too.
Okay.
Hi, this is Steve Hall. And, the Stand Down Texas Project, and I did add a link to our Execution Watch website for Steve. And let's see, you were the chief of staff to the AG of Texas from 83 to 91.
That's correct.
I'm trying to think. Who was that? Was that Mark White?
No, that was Attorney General Jim Maddox, who
that was Maddox.
Unfortunately died overnight last night.
Jim Maddox died?
Yes, he died in his sleep overnight. It was announced today, and funeral and burial will be on Tuesday in Austin.
Well, of course, Jim was opposed to the death penalty.
To
the extent possible.
He was present for executions. It was the law of the land.
Right.
But he was certainly troubled by many aspects of capital punishment in Texas, and... he told his lawyers in the law enforcement division that he wanted to review the cases personally. He wanted them to go over the cases with him. If they saw a problem, he wanted them to come to him. And he said, I don't know what we'll do, but we'll figure out something. And he had an impact in several cases, one that's most publicly known of, was Henry Lee Lucas. Henry Lee Lucas had a death sentence and from Williamson County, and a district attorney came to General Maddox and was concerned about the confessions that were going on that Henry Lee Lucas was giving to hundreds of murders across America. And General Maddox investigated the investigation and determined that Henry Lee Lucas was likely in Florida at the time of the murder in Texas for which he was convicted and sentenced to death. And this report with the state seal on it was really the basis for the single commutation of a death sentence by then Governor George Bush.
Well, I think, you know, didn't we find out Henry Lee Lucas had a very vivid imagination.
Yeah, he's the one that he's in Florida and got here by a flying saucer, I think. That was
okay.
The one or something.
Star Trek
machine. Yeah.
Did you have any connection with the Hudson case?
No, I have not.
Okay. But tell me more about what you've been doing, because clearly you have a connection with this issue. I'm not sure what to ask you. You're host of speechless here.
To advocate for a moratorium on executions in Texas and a state-sponsored review. At that time, we were in a wave of executions. That year, you may recall, in 2000, Texas carried out 40 executions. Now, that's almost one a week. And, in fact, that's the highest number of executions in any one year by any one state in America. Gary Graham was executed that summer. A case that many people, including myself, believe that he was innocent. This was a case in which there was a single eyewitness who identified him. Unfortunately, he had such poor lawyering by an appointed attorney that that lawyer did not call eyewitnesses to the crime who did not identify Gary Graham, or one, in fact, who said, that's not him, that's not the guy. How do you know? Wrong height. How do you know? And this witness told how he determined the height of the shooter. There was a growing awareness of the problems. In Illinois, Governor George Ryan had imposed a moratorium on executions in that state, appointed a blue ribbon commission that looked top to bottom at the root problems in the criminal justice system to the death penalty.
They got him for that.
And came out with a full report of needed reforms from the top to the bottom, from police investigative procedures all the way through executive clemency. And so that's when the project formed, and we continue to work on those issues as well as other indigent criminal justice issues that are vitally important to people across the state.
What are you finding here in Texas?
Well, of course, in Texas,
what makes
we are still seeing
unique.
A lot of executions. But it's important to note that we are mirroring the rest of the country in that we're seeing fewer death sentences and fewer executions. So that's one very important trend. Also, particularly since 2001, there is a greater and, I think, growing awareness that we do have a broken system in Texas, and the legislature has made some steps towards progress. The Task Force on Indigent Defense has made some improvements in the system, and right now, Judge Barbara Hervey of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, she has convened a Texas Criminal Justice Integrity Unit that is examining some of these problems. And to go back to Gary Graham's case, one of the most pressing issues is eyewitness identification. There are now reforms in place that we know cuts the number of wrong identifications. And one of the model police agencies using model procedures is right here in Texas, in Richardson, Texas. So we're seeing progress, but we certainly still see problems. And all you have to do is look at the Charles Hood case, the case out of Plano, in which the trial judge and the prosecutor had a romantic affair going on that was a secret that was not disclosed to Mr. Hood's attorneys at the time of trial. And frankly, the Court of Criminal Appeals has done everything to avoid confronting the reality of that problem.
One of the things that I've noticed about the, you know, activism in respect to the death penalty is there seem to be two strains. One is anti-death penalty, like this doesn't work. And the other one is accuracy. In other words, making sure that people really are guilty. I think what Governor, I can't think of his name, in Illinois did.
Governor Ryan?
Was it Governor Ryan? Yeah.
George Ryan.
George Ryan. Was dealing with the accuracy, not the death penalty itself. Talk about that a little bit. Am I right that there are these two different strains?
I'd say that that's correct. And the Stand Down Project was created specifically to work with supporters of the death penalty who understood that we have a broken system, as well as opponents of the death penalty are concerned that innocent men and women continue to be exonerated from death row and from the general prison system. I think there are. There are people who have a reasoned moral opposition to the death penalty as a fundamental violation of human rights. You also have people who may support the death penalty in principle. They may support it as a matter of fact that it is the law of the state right now, but who want to ensure that if we're going to have a death penalty, that it work to select the worst of the worst for society's worst punishment. And unfortunately, in Texas, that's an area that we see time after time where there's an over-prosecution of death penalty cases. There is a widespread geographic disparity, which means that you're talking about prosecutorial authority and decision-making and who gets the death penalty. And this case tonight is an example of a case. It was, without a doubt, a brutal crime, but it appears to be a crime of passion, not a premeditated crime, a crime that is not the worst of the worst for which Texas reserves the death penalty.
Yeah, it seems that the prosecutors adding charges and so forth because I guess they, in Texas, I guess you look better if you're tougher. And tougher, of course, means being far more powerful than the people you're. I was going to say persecuting,
strange.
But I want to change that.
Craig Watkins, the relatively new district attorney in Dallas, is attracting a lot of positive attention.
Yes.
For recognizing his office's responsibility to correct injustices. And I think that there are a lot of prosecutors who appreciate what he's saying, that it's time for them to clean up their own act.
What can we do? What would be your recommendation to people who might be listening who want to pursue this?
Well, I'd say that there are several things. First of all, they need to write the governor. They need to write the Board of Pardons and Paroles in cases like this. They need to make those leaders understand that people are watching. Second thing, we have a legislative session coming up. Texas only has a legislative session for approximately 5 months every 2 years,
mm-hmm.
The only time legislation gets passed. There will be legislation to give the governor authority to impose a moratorium, a power that he actually does not have right now. There'll be legislation for a death penalty study commission.
Where will we know about this?
People should support those efforts.
Is this on your website? I guess you'll be showing that.
Absolutely. There'll be information about the session, and people can go to standdown.org, and there's an index on the right column, and they can find out more on any of the discrete issues of the death penalty.
Okay, and there's a link to that on the Execution Watch website, too. I put a link up.
It's an excellent website.
So, okay, Steve, we'll be talking to you again.
Very good.
Thank you very much. Steve Hall, director of the Stand Down Texas Project. And we have a couple. It's 100%. It's great. Jim, we were talking about, I'm trying to remember.
We're talking about some things to change things.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not too big on this letter writing. I don't think letter writing does a hell of a lot of good to anybody.
I feel, because I get this a lot, what is it going to do for me to write a letter to John Cornyn to say we should impeach Bush?
Here's what we should do. It's real simple. It's nothing complicated. Politicians respond to two things, voting power and money. Real simple. And what happens if we could get an organization started on a website and start registering people to vote, set up a website and start getting some political clout through registered voters and screening candidates on issues involving prison reform? That's how the civil rights movement worked for blacks. That's how it worked for gays. It wouldn't be because all of a sudden they like blacks and gays. They were they'd get their ass voted out of office if they didn't go along with it. And you've only got one thing, voting right and money. That's it. And if you have voting power, if you have a perception of voting power, and it just seems logical to me that one of the aspects of a program like this should be an activist program to start encouraging people to register to vote, keep a list, a database of people who are interested in these issues, keep them up to date on newsletters, and start endorsing candidates by votes. Because the reason the gay political caucus in Houston became powerful is that they felt you had to have that endorsement to become elected a judge. Right. Now, there are enough people in this community who've had kids who've been to the penitentiary before, if they would bind together in a voting block, they could have some impact. Writing letters, you might as well, you're wasting postage stamps. And I think the thing to do is through a voting block power, through money. Money's going to be out of the question because most of these folks have no money. But we can damn sure organize and set up a system where people will be encouraged to vote, and we can start screening candidates just like the gay political caucus does. So that's what I think we should do, one of the things. There are many more things I have in mind, but that's one of them.
The wisdom of Jim Skelton?
I don't know about that. But
an attorney who is luckily on the right side, because I would hate to have you on the other side. I'd probably be killing a lot more people. My name's Otis McClay. This is Execution Watch. I've been sitting in for Ray Hill. This is the last execution this year because, in true Christian spirit, the state does not execute anybody between Thanksgiving and New Year's so that we can all enjoy our holidays. I think that's just wonderful. What are we saying? Okay, the next execution, the next scheduled execution, and we can always, hope for a stay. We had two this week, a stay and a reschedule, I guess. The next scheduled one is January 14th, 2 days before my birthday. And the state intends to kill, by very civilized means, lethal injection, Curtis Moore. And we will be back not before then. And, of course, I want to thank Ray and Elizabeth Stein, who is our producer, for inventing this and getting me involved. Usually I get to sit in the other room and say, yep, we're still online. By January, we'll be back on HD2. The studio transmitter link is up. It's just we're not using it yet. And I trust that this crew will be here. Jim Skelton, attorney Jim Skelton, Esquire.
I hope he's not Esquire.
I like that. Jim Skelton, Esquire, will be here in his purple cowboy suit. And we will be, I don't know how to behave about a death penalty event. You know, I can't really be light and cheerful. It's a shame that we live in a state and a country that thinks that somehow doing this will make us all safer. Until January, have as good a holiday as it's possible to have. Thank you.
was fresh out of the service. That was back in 82. I raised some cane when I come back to town. Meant to be all I can be. Come home without a clue. Married Dawn and had to settle down. So I hired on at the prison. Guess I always knew I would. Just like my dad and both my uncles done. And I worked on every cell block. Now things are going good. Then they transferred me to LSU Unit 1.
Don't live on LSU.